The Long Decline in Fact and Fiction.
We are not going to run Walt Disney World and suburbia and the interstate highway system and Walmart on any combination of alternative fuels. We're going to be very disappointed in what these things can do for us. So in the world of the novel, an awful lot has been lost and left behind.
That's futurist James Howard Kunstler. We'll talk with him about The Witch of Hebron, his latest novel about a post-industrial, post-collapse America.
100 years ago, half of the American population worked in agriculture. 100 years from now, we'll probably be in the same boat because we won't have the diesel fuel to power the combines and all that kind of stuff. And so it's back to, you know, hands and horses and hoes.
And that's John Michael Greer. He spells out how we get to and get through the collapse of industrial civilization. His book is The Ecotechnic Future. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. What'll be the final straw that brings our civilization down? Pandemic flu? Peak oil? The drought and floods of climate change? Maybe we'll be lucky, and it'll just be another mega financial meltdown. It could be any or all of these. Our guests today are much concerned about the impending decline and fall of our civilization as they see it. Our first guest, James Howard Kunstler, calls it the long emergency. He wrote about it in a nonfiction book of that title. He says it'll be driven by the end of cheap, abundant fossil fuels, and it'll be replaced by a society based on small-scale, agrarian, or semi-rural communities. It's not an all-bad thing. While much is lost, something is gained: greater community and a more intimate relationship with nature. Kunstler wants us to wrap our minds around the looming transition to that future, and he thinks fiction might be the best way to get us to do that. He's just published a second in a series of novels about that near-future society. The first was called World Made by Hand. His second picks up the thread. Its title, The Witch of Hebron. I caught up with James Howard Kunstler by phone in his hotel room in Portland, Oregon, where he was on book tour. I started out by asking him to give us the background to his fiction, to tell us about The Long Emergency.
Well, The Long Emergency, published in 2005, was a book discussing the global oil predicament and the global banking fiasco and global warming, and how all of these things and quite a few other things, including geopolitical mischief, had a chance to put us out of business as an advanced civilization. And the World Made by Hand book was a novel attempting to vividly portray what it would be like to live in a kind of post-economic collapse America. It was set in a small town in upstate New York some years after things had settled out. The electricity was off for good. People were living very locally and, in fact, had scant knowledge of what was going on in other parts of the USA. Their life had become kind of centered around agriculture. And, that was the sort of takeoff point for really what were intended to be a series of ripping yarns to give people this sense of the texture of a future that's not too far away.
When you say not too far away, give us an idea of the time frame you're thinking of here.
We are in the zone of the long emergency. Things are underway. You know, the banking fiasco is now accelerating to a point where it's really causing some damage. The oil predicament is always in the background of our lives and is going to continue to affect us. The price of oil, as we speak, is over $82 a barrel now. And that, by the way, is above the level where it too starts to hurt the economy very badly. So there are all these sort of reinforcing effects of these things. So we're in the zone of the long emergency. We're heading into big trouble, political instability. I think people already understand the symptoms of that. And a standard of living that is going down, down, down.
Now, you talk about the peak oil phenomenon. I know one concern that is front and center for me is climate change, and yet that doesn't seem to play that big a role in your books.
It does actually in this sense, and I think this is the way it's going to play out in the short to medium term for us. Climate change is going to express itself first probably in the form of problems with the food supply. And we're already seeing that with crop failures in major grain-producing parts of the world, like Australia, which produces a lot of the grain for China, Russia, a major grain producer, which has had a terrible summer of drought and fire, and other parts of the world. And the grain stocks in the worldwide have never been lower than they are now. Just because there are cheese doodles on the shelves of the supermarket doesn't mean that we're in good shape.
Now, your book, and this is the second in a series, tell us a little bit, maybe set us up. Tell us a little bit about what the first in the series covered.
The first book, World Made by Hand, established the world of this small town called Union Grove in Washington County, New York, a little corner of the Northeast between the Hudson River and the Vermont border. And the people of this town are now living without electricity in what has become kind of an agricultural community. People who were working in corporate jobs are now working as carpenters and farm laborers. And the actual plot of World Made by Hand was largely concerned with the following. A group of Christian evangelicals arrives from the South, where there's apparently a lot of disorder in the Sun Belt. A lot of social disorder. And this evangelical group arrives and buys the high school, which is not being used anymore, and moves in to establish their headquarters. And their culture begins to clash with the culture of the regular townspeople. And the plot proceeds from there, partly involving shenanigans with a hostage and ransom racket taking place in the city of Albany, in the port of Albany, where river trade is going on, because that's the only way that things can move around the United States now, is by water. And World Made by Hand takes place 3 months later in the week around Halloween of the same year.
World Made by Hand or The Witch?
I'm sorry, The Witch of Hebron. Excuse me. The Witch of Hebron takes place 4 months later after the first novel. And at the center of the book is a character who is only in the background in the first, and that's the 11-year-old son of the town doctor who commits a crime and has to run away from town and home and his parents and everything he knows, and is at large in the county because he can't get very far. You know, he can't hitchhike or hop a freight train because there are no cars running and there are no trains running. And he falls into the company of a 19-year-old psychopathic bandit who then proceeds to go on a crime spree of about a week's duration with this kid in his company. And so the whole question really is whether this kid's childhood will be redeemed. And all of the action takes place against the background of a failed economy and a society that's really sort of heading back into quasi-medievalism.
And before we go further into the actual story, which is a great yarn, and I think you tell it just wonderfully.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit more about this technology. We're going back, I'd say, probably about 200 years. It's almost like back to colonialism. How did that happen? I mean, is this just partly a fictional construct, or do you think that we are really going to lose even the knowledge that we've had? Why so back? Why can't we, for example, have renewable energy if we don't have
oil?
Well,
there's a great deal of delusional thinking about that right now. And, you know, you can state categorically that as the economic distress increases, the delusional thinking and the wishful thinking is going to increase. And what I've said in The Long Emergency and in articles since then is that we are not going to run Walt Disney World and suburbia and the interstate highway system and Walmart on any combination of alternative fuels. We're going to be very disappointed in what these things can do for us. So in the world of the novel, an awful lot has been lost and left behind. You know, we're suffering right now as a society from what I would call techno-grandiosity. We simply have inflated a notion of what technology can do for us. Among other things, technology and energy are not substitutes for each other. If you run out of one, you cannot plug in the other. And we are going to get into trouble, big trouble, with our energy supply. And as that occurs, the complex systems that we depend on for an advanced industrial society, these complex systems are going to wobble and fail, and they're going to reinforce each other's failures as this occurs. So in the world of the book, in the world made by hand novel and The Witch of Hebron, this is exactly what has occurred. And all the systems for transportation and commerce and food production and getting the food to the supermarkets and, you know, running things the way we do, these systems have failed the people of my little community. And actually, they are losing information and knowledge. And to some extent, you know, all of the baggage of the Enlightenment is failing them. You know, technology is failing them. Science is failing them. And they are actually entering a kind of a new world view, which has a lot to do with the re-enchantment of life.
Yeah, that's the other side of the coin there, the re-enchantment of life. Really what you're saying is that something's lost, but something's gained.
You bet. They're gaining a lot. Well, just in practical terms, they're no longer subjected to the tyranny of machines and motors incessantly. You know, they can actually hear the world that's going on around them, and they can hear the birds, and they can smell the fresh-cut hay, and their lives have become very sense-connected to the world they live in. They're working shoulder-to-shoulder with their neighbors at things that matter. They're making music, homemade music themselves, instead of being just subject to canned entertainment. And their worldview is changing. And what I've set up in the novel is, of course, the conflict between this kind of neo-medieval, superstitious, semi-magical worldview of the Christian cultists and the worldview of the Enlightenment, which is kind of fading away, which is, you know, the way ordinary townspeople, it's this residue of their belief system that they grew up with. And, you know, we're seeing the perception of the world change as the world itself changes in a practical way.
I'm speaking with futurist James Howard Kunstler. He's the author of the nonfiction book, The Long Emergency, about the world after peak oil. It's a world he writes about in his fiction. His first novel was World Made by Hand. His second in the series is The Witch of Hebron. And yet these evangelicals, I mean, they're not painted with just a rosy brush. I mean, there's some pretty serious conflict here between intolerance and tolerance.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, originally I thought when I started writing the first book that they might actually be the villains of the piece. But I got to like them so much. They're kind of appealing characters. And at the center of their thing is their leader, who styles himself Brother Job. And he's an interesting creation. He's sort of a combination of Boss Hogg and Captain Ahab. You know, he's a somewhat comical figure, but he's also rather dark. And he appears to have some strange abilities that go beyond the purely natural abilities of people to control things and control others. And you know, his group and his way of doing things represents quite a threat to the ordinary people of town.
And he's met his match in a way in this book, although he really doesn't meet her until the end of the book. I assume the woman that you call the Witch of Hebron, this is someone who would be quite recognizable to, I think, a lot of the denizens of the Happy Valley here, the Pioneer Valley in western Massachusetts, kind of an earthy, crunchy, spiritual mama.
Yeah, she represents pretty much the nurturing spirit of the earth, but she's a sexy woman. And She's a very interesting, smart woman with a lot of capabilities and powers that also seem to rise above the strictly normal. But she and Brother Job, I think, come to an understanding with each other that has a lot to do with the plot of the story. And yes, he's not only met his match, but like a lot of other people in the book, he's fallen in love with her.
I think you did too.
Well, she's an appealing character. You know, we all love a wonderful, smart, sexy, beautiful woman.
There are a number of other characters. I'm not sure how much time we really have to go into the plot here, but just to stretch it out a little bit, you also have another character. It's a holdover from the previous book, actually, a number of them. This is a man who has been able to roll the punches, come out on top, become a wealthy landowner, even has electricity.
Yes, this would be Mr. Bullock, who has become kind of the feudal grandee of the neighborhood. He starts out with a farm, before the collapse. But as things get gnarly, he acquires much of the land around him until he has thousands and thousands of acres. And he starts acquiring people, too, the people in failed occupations and failed jobs that are connected with corporate life that have been left behind, like, you know, the car dealers, the pharmacists. They start coming into him to be live on his property. He builds a little village for them, and they basically become his feudal peasants and serve him. And he's very successful in his way within the terms of the world that's been set up. But, you know, he represents something that's a little bit ominous and dark, which is that in the years to come, people may be so desperate in America that they will have to sell their allegiance to someone for security and food.
Because of the breakdown of the law.
Well, because there is no corporate job structure anymore. There is no ordinary economy as we know it. And the economy has become kind of an agricultural economy. And if you're not doing something connected with that, or if you don't have some important craft skill of some kind, you know, whether it's carpentry or something else, you know, you basically have to work in food production mm-hmm. on the farm. And that's what a lot of his people do.
Now, so what are the practical lessons that you want people to take from this book? Because I assume that to some degree, you're writing fiction because you think there may be a broader reach to it. Is that right?
Well, I did want to get across what this new world would feel like, but it's, you know, I'm not trying to be didactic. You know, I'm not trying to be pedantic about it. I do think that we're headed for trouble, but I think we have to be brave. You know, the point is we have to be brave. We can't afford to be crybabies. We've got to put our shoulder to the wheel. We've got to start getting realistic about what reality is telling us. We've got to stop pretending that everything is okay. And we've got to make some real plans, real practical plans for reforming the systems that we rely on in America, or we are going to lose a lot if we don't do it. If we don't get our act together with growing more food locally, if we don't rebuild those local networks of economic interdependency that we called main streets or business districts, if we don't make a few things in America again, and if we cannot reestablish the rule of law in banking, then we're going to be in a lot of trouble in this country.
Have you heard of the Transition Towns movement?
I have, and they're certainly a good thing. They exist because the people involved recognize that we face a rather severe transition or set of transitions, and they are hoping to do something about it, to prepare people for it, and we can only applaud their effort. The only caution I would issue is do not go too far down the road of techno-grandiosity. We are not going to run all the cars by other means. You know, we're going to have to get much more into things like walkable communities and even transit, and I hope restoring the railroad, passenger railroad system in America, because if we don't do any of that, we ain't going anywhere.
James Howard Kunstler, your book is The Witch of Hebron. It's the second in a series of novels. I assume there's going to be a third.
Well, yeah, I want to write one for each of the four seasons, like Vivaldi.
Wonderful. The first was World Made by Hand. This is The Witch of Hebron. I know you have to go now, so we have to cut our interview a little bit short, but thanks so much for talking with us here.
Francesca, it's a pleasure, and I hope you have a better second half of the day and the rain stops over there.
Well, it's part of climate change in a wetter world, I'd say.
We've had a lot of weird weather this year, especially in the Northeast. It's true.
Yeah, we have. All right. Well, best of luck on your book tour then.
We will ride again.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. James Howard Kunstler is also the author of The Geography of Nowhere and The Long Emergency. You can hear his lecture about the long emergency by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with John Michael Greer about the ecotechnic future. Today we're talking about the end of the industrial age, an age my guests, James Howard Kunstler, who we talked with in today's first segment, and my next guest, John Michael Greer, have been thinking and writing about for a long time. Greer is the author of The Long Descent, A User's Guide to the End of the Industrial Age. His new book is The Ecotechnic Future, Exploring a Post-Peak World. It's a fascinating read. In it, Greer says we humans are going through a natural process for all species, the process of succession, whereby old stages of existence give way to new ones. Greer says we've now passed the stage of abundance industrialism and are in scarcity industrialism. Next to come is salvage industrialism, and, if we're smart and lucky, an ecotechnic future. Your book, The Ecotechnic Future, in it you say that the industrial world no longer has the resources or the time to change fast enough to stave off its own decline and fall. It's a pretty grim look, and yet you do find some reasons for hope in the long term. First of all, just tell us, what does ecotechnic mean?
Okay, well, the term, I coined it, although I found out later that somebody else came up with it at the same time. One of the great needs that we face right now is the need to start realizing that we have to work with natural cycles rather than just riding roughshod over them, as we've done for the last 300 years since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. We've built a technology that assumes that we can have all the energy we need whenever we want it, and that we can just ignore nature by, you know, cranking up the thermostat when it gets cold, cranking up the air conditioning when it gets hot, all this kind of stuff. We can't live like that anymore. We've been running through the Earth's finite supplies of concentrated energy to the point that we can't expect to have as much energy as we want, as abundantly, as concentrated, as convenient as we're used to. We need to start working with nature. I've used heating and cooling as just a kind of a convenient example, but this sort of thing pervades our entire way of life. And all that has to change. And one of the things we can do at this point about that is to begin looking at how we can work with natural cycles instead of against them, how we can develop an ecotechnology.
And an ecotechnology, you know, when I first read that, I thought that this was kind of along the lines, before I read the book, when I just looked at the title, mm-hmm. but this was kind of along the lines of people who say that technology will save us. it isn't. Your book isn't like that at all.
No. The problem is, technology isn't a god. It's just a set of tools. And now, a set of tools is a very useful thing to have, but it will not save you, especially when what you wanted to save you from are the consequences of your own stupid decisions. We keep on making a set of progressively more counterproductive, dumb decisions about how we're dealing with limited resources and other ecological limits. Our tools will not save us from that because we're using the tools in ways that make the problem worse.
You know, it's interesting because just A couple of days ago, as I'm talking with you here, I read a chilling article in the New York Times, which says that the world is running out of the rare earth elements, that green technology, like powerful batteries that can store wind energy and solar.
Lithium for high-tech batteries, some of the other elements for the magnets that are used in like wind generators. There's dozens of these things. They are, in fact, quite rare. There are certain places in the world that have them, and many others don't. And the places where they're currently being mined, which are primarily not in the developed world, as you'd expect, the methods of production are horrifically ecologically toxic.
That's right. And so, I mean, I think that was the point of the article. But the other point of the article, or at least that I got from it, is that the very technologies that we hope might save us, using wind and solar and things of that kind, we may be running out of those as well.
You can't just shift from one non-renewable resource to another non-renewable resource if your problem is based on the fact that you're relying on non-renewable resources. You actually have to stop and say, okay, what do we actually have that's renewable? And that doesn't mean, what can we use non-renewable technology to get? What do we have where the whole stream is renewable? Renewable energy access to renewable ways over the long term, that's actual sustainability, not replacing one set of expensive, cumbersome technologies with another set that's even more fragile and based on more limited resources.
You have a wonderful sentence in the book on page 219, which I'm going to read because I think it sums it up so well. Human limits, not human power, define the situation we face today, because the technological revolutions and economic boom times that most modern people take for granted were a product not of science or such impressive intangibles as the human spirit, but simply a brief period of extravagance in which we squandered half a billion years of stored sunlight.
People will do anything other than grasp that. I've watched this in the course of my blog over the last, what, 3.5 years now, having conversations with people about energy issues, about just a wide range of issues of this kind, and the number of people for whom there can't possibly be any limits that we can't overcome. You know, there's got to be a way around any limit because we've got science, we've got technology, we're smarter than anyone else in history, like we are. You know, we've got the human spirit, blah, blah, blah. There's always an excuse. There's always a reason. But what it all boils down to is that progress, the belief in progress, is the state religion of the modern world. We believe in it the way a medieval peasant believes in the wonder-working powers of, you know, the same, what's his name? It's not necessarily so. But people are not too happy with that idea when you point it out to them.
We're talking with John Michael Greer about a sustainable ecotechnology in a post-peak oil world. His book is The Ecotechnic Future. Stay tuned for much more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with John Michael Greer about his book, The Ecotechnic Future. It's about how we can survive the end of the industrial age in a post-peak oil world. Well, you point out that we should, in the ecotechnic future, that we should be thinking about ourselves much more as we think about nature. That is, that we are part of the ecology of the planet, and that we go through very, very much the same kinds of cycles that other species go through. Explain the idea of succession and what your idea of human succession is.
Okay. Succession is one of the fundamental concepts of modern ecology. The idea is that if you start with bare ground, the example I use in the book, as I recall, is one of these areas that was cleared for a bunch of new expensive houses back when we had a housing boom. You clear land down to the dirt, and even if it's in an area where you're going to end up with forest, eventually it doesn't start as forest. What happens is first the weeds move in, then the grasses move in, then the shrubs move in, each of them with a complete suite of different other life forms, different fungi in the soil, different insects, different animals live there. And it moves through a succession of what are called seres or seral stages until it finally, several cycles down the road, and often a couple of hundred years down the road, finally reaches what's called its climax community, which is a stable state. Now, we've known all about this in ecology for years and years and years, but we don't like applying this to ourselves because our notion is that there isn't such a thing as a human stable state. No, we're headed off to some grand, progressive future, maybe some glorious Star Trek future splashed across the galaxy, maybe something like that. But in fact, human societies go through a similar succession process. In history, this has happened. You'll have some kind of new technological breakthrough, let's say the invention of agriculture. And when agricultural societies first developed, they were fairly short-term prospects because with a fairly simple agricultural technology and no notion that you maybe need to restore soil fertility, agricultural societies boom and bust. And then the next agricultural society is a slower boom and a slower bust. And over the generations, new techniques come in, people realize that manure goes into fields and you get better results. They realize that, you rotate crops, you use nitrogen-fixing plants and all that kind of stuff. And the end result is the kind of sustainable agriculture you get in, you had, for example, in traditional East Asia, where you have the same rice paddies producing a stable crop of rice for thousands of years with no loss of soil fertility. They're making it all up with manure. They're making it all up with all of these tricks of the trade that they've evolved. This is how natural systems work. Our technological society, well, we think that exempts us from it, but it doesn't. Our technological society is one of those very early weed-style boom and bust seral stages. My theory is that what we're going to see from here on in, as we as a species learn how to live with some kind of technology, probably nothing like so extravagant as we have now, is that we're going to see this series of historical cycles of different civilizations, different cultures that rise and fall as their technology slowly becomes more stable as they finally reaching a climax community, which would be the technical equivalent of one of these East Asian rice paddies, which could be sustainable for the very long term, but we're not there yet.
We'll talk about these stages. First of all, starting with where we are, this mm-hmm. kind of, I forget the word, what you name it, extravagant technology?
Abundance industrialism.
Right, abundance industrialism.
The economy of abundance industrialism, that's not actually where we are now. That's where we have been. We still all think that's, or most of us think that's where we are now, but we're not. Abundance industrialism is based on the idea that every year you can produce more energy resources than you did the year before. And it's, as long as you can carry that off, it's a great thing. You can, more energy means more economic production, means everything goes zooming upwards. But on a finite planet, you can only do that for so long. We've been running into the, since the 1970s, really, when the limits to growth started to bite, we've been running into the first signs that abundance industrialism is coming to an end. And we have not dealt with that well. We could have. I mean, there were a lot of very promising initiatives in the 70s that had this crap stomped out of them with the counter-reaction of the 80s and 90s, which really lost us a lot of time and a lot of opportunity that we could have put to good use. But so we've got this society that's geared to growth, that's geared to basically maximizing the process of turning natural resources into waste. That's the way it works, The more natural resources we turn into waste, the more prosperous we think we are. In anything but the psychology of an abundance industrial society, that's idiotic. The more things you waste, that doesn't make you prosperous.
Well, I think probably a lot of people wouldn't make that leap.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by turning industrial products into waste?
Well, no, turning natural resources into waste.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What is the gross? Mm-hmm. I mean, the gross national product is measured by how much production. Okay, every act of economic production takes in some kind of resource from nature, and turns out some kind of waste. So the more economic production you have, the more economic activity you have, the more waste you're producing, the more natural resources you're using up.
But wouldn't that happen in any case? I mean, anytime you use natural resources, what about recycling? I mean, people don't necessarily have to take natural resources and create waste. We could, within the framework of this society, recycle things, use technology to do that.
We have started doing that, and that's part of the transition from the old economy of abundance industrialism into the next economy of scarcity industrialism. We're going to see a lot more of that as these processes unfold. But recycling suffers in most cases. There's some cases where it doesn't. Aluminum recycling, for example, takes less energy than actually refining aluminum from ore. But in most cases, it's more troublesome, more costly, a little more of a burden on the economy to have to recycle than it is to use raw materials. And so recycling picks up only as the supply of raw materials declines. Also, there are crucial resources that can't be recycled. The most important are fuels. When you burn a gallon of gasoline, you can't recycle it. I mean, the energy, which is what you're getting out of it, is gone. Literally speaking, the energy is converted into waste heat. Energy is never created or destroyed. But in economic terms, the energy is gone.
Yeah, you talk about energy as a one-way proposition.
Energy is a one-way material cycle, or materials can cycle. They don't have to. You can have a one-way material street, which is what so much of our economy runs on these days. You know, we take in metal ores, we fill up landfills, or what have you. But it doesn't have to be that way. Energy is always a one-way street. And so what that means is that over time, you have to limit your energy use to what you can actually get in terms of amount, but also in terms of concentration, from sources that are renewing themselves all the time, which on this planet means mostly sunlight.
We're talking with John Michael Greer. His book is The Ecotechnic Future. I asked John Michael Greer what he thought of China's and India's plans to fully enter into abundance industrialism.
There isn't enough fossil fuels left on the planet. We've already passed what's called peak oil, the point where the world's total production of conventional petroleum has reached its all-time peak and begun to decline. Depending on exactly how you do the figures, that was either in 2005 or in 2008. And it's history, okay? From here on, for the rest of human existence, the amount of petroleum we can get from the ground is going to go down. So given that we've already got the minority of people in the developed world basically fully committed to using that petroleum. Now, people think, oh, well, what about natural gas? What about coal? Natural gas, even with the much ballyhooed recent shale gas discoveries, natural gas is on track to peak in about 2030, or about 20 years from now. Coal, well, you know, everyone was saying there are thousands of years of coal. Well, you know, that kind of talk is great to boost stock prices. Every time the people have actually gone and reviewed the information behind it, the actual hard facts on the ground, they've reduced the amount of coal we have by an incredible percentage. We're probably going to reach peak coal around 2040, according to Richard Heinberg, who's researched the subject most effectively in recent times. So about 30 years from now. So by that time, we're at a point where all fossil fuel reserves are tapering off.
Right, but they're still being extracted.
Oh, they're still being extracted. But you're not going to be able to bring, say, 1.2 billion Chinese and, what is it, 800 million Indians up to an industrial world standard when the amount of energy that is currently maintaining the industrial world at its current standard is tapering off.
Well, of course, a lot of people say by that time the transition to clean, renewable fuels will be made.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, why don't you answer that? And then I have a follow-up to that question.
Oh, sure. Renewable energy is great. It's the energy we're going to have left when we finish wasting the fossil fuels. But the problem with renewable energy is that, first of all, it is much less concentrated. And concentration is hugely important when it comes to energy. The reason fossil fuels are so useful is that they're incredibly concentrated. They give off a vast amount of energy in a very small space. The amount of energy in a gallon of gasoline, if you want to store that in car batteries, you need 1 ton of car batteries, okay, in 1 gallon of gasoline.
Well,
and
so far.
And, no, the thing is, yes, you can make bigger batteries, but the point is none of the other energy sources are particularly concentrated, and it takes energy to concentrate energy. In the case of oil and coal and natural gas, that energy to concentrate that energy was put in by natural processes over millions and millions of years. We don't have millions and millions of years to get something up and up to that level of concentration, and that means we have to do the concentration ourselves and pay the energy cost.
Okay, so having put that aside, the idea that advanced technology will save us, talk about the next stage. We talked a bit about salvage. Say a little bit more about the salvage industrialism, and then what is going to follow from that, and and how this works. I mean, this is the process of succession.
The process of succession. Mm-hmm. At every stage in the successional process, what you get, the organisms that thrive are the ones that can thrive best under the conditions, under the energy supply, under the resources available that you have in that time. Thus, what we're seeing now, the emergence of scarcity industrialism. There's a lot of yelling in the media these days about resource nationalism and things like that, where, you know, countries are saying, okay, I've got this resource, and, you know, we're not necessarily going to give it to the industrial world just because somebody there wants it. You're going to have a lot of this stuff where there will be, globalism has passed its prime. We still have fossil fuels. There's still uranium to burn in reactors. There's still coal and all this kind of stuff. And while that happens, while those are, you know, the fuels du jour, I think we're going to see society really orient around that. Salvage is the next stage. When we've basically used up enough of the fossil fuels that isn't an option anymore. At that point, renewables are what's left, and we will get to see how much of a renewable economy we can maintain without having these constant inputs of fossil fuels that we use to, like, build our wind turbines and our solar cells and this kind of stuff. But in the process, the single largest source of resources at that point becomes, ruins. Basically, the remains of today's extravagant economy. You're starting to see a little bit of that in some of the most economically devastated parts of the Rust Belt, in Detroit, for example, where, well, for that matter, in any one of these abandoned suburban subdivisions from the housing bubble, where it's an illegal business, but a very profitable one, to go in and strip houses of their wiring and their copper tubing and things like that, because you can sell it. This is the beginning of a salvage economy. My guess is that over the next century or so, we're going to see a point where salvaging resources, salvaging technology, salvaging things that can be made to work under a simpler, lower energy condition is going to be a major economic sector. And it's going to maintain a lot of things that might otherwise fall apart because, you know, you can get the parts. As long you don't have to be able to build the thing from scratch. You know, it's like when Rome fell, a huge number of cities in medieval Europe had access to running water out of Roman aqueducts. They couldn't have built them, but they could get somebody up there to repair them. So in the same way, the salvage societies of the middle future will be able to maintain certain technologies on the basis of, you know, can we get the parts? What do we have to scrap in order to keep this running? And finally, my thought, I mean, it's and this is where it starts getting speculative, but as that starts running low, as we reach the point where the only scrap remaining are the trillions of tons of steel, say, that are in structural girders and things like that, which will keep blacksmiths going for, you know, thousands of years. At a certain point, though, the last of the computers run dead, and there are no more old abandoned storage lockers to loot for spare parts and things like that. And you reach a point where we're down to what we can do with strictly renewable resources. And at that point, these ecotechnic processes that I've suggested, ways of working with nature instead of against it, are arguably the most economically viable approach we've got.
Will we even have the resources to work with nature?
Well, I mean, hunter-gatherers work with nature. You don't need much. And the question is, at what point, you know, what level can we maintain? And that's actually one of the core themes of the book, because the level of technology we're able to maintain in the future depends in large part on what people do right now. We have the capacity to preserve information. We have the capacity to preserve simpler technologies, the technologies of recent generations, that could still be used 1,000 years from now.
And give us some examples.
Oh, here's one of my favorites, largely because it the only people who really get it are you know, retired Harrier engineer types. A slide rule. An electronic calculator and a slide rule can do basically the same thing. The difference is that an electronic calculator requires a huge technostructure to manufacture. You can't have it unless you have, you know, chip fabrication plants, and unless you have, you know, various exotic rare earth elements to dope the silicon chips with. If you don't have those, you don't have a pocket calculator. You can make a slide rule with hand tools. The first slide rules were made with hand tools. The oldest slide rule dates from like the 17th century, and it's not an inadequate tool. Most of the number crunching that put human footprints on the moon was done with slide rules. If the slide rule as a technology makes it through our current window of extravagance, then people on the downslope are going to have an effective way to crunch numbers. Which, you know, you say, oh well, it's crunching numbers. Most technologies depend on the ability to come up with accurate calculations fast.
You also talk about conserving the scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
That's the big one. The core of science is actually a method. It's a way of asking questions about nature and testing your suppositions until you find out what works or what doesn't. That method is rarely taught these days. You can go through, I went through a what was considered a fairly good public school education plus university without ever actually being formally introduced to it, much less being asked to, come up with a hypothesis, figure out what experiment would falsify the hypothesis, and put it to the test. You can teach six-year-olds to do this in simple ways, but we don't. And the problem there is that the scientific method is the heart of the whole thing. If you lose that, all you've got are a bunch of dogmas.
And when we talk about scientific method, we're talking about, as you say, testing hypotheses, having groups, randomly assigned control groups,
not anecdotes about what works. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's even simpler than that. It's the idea that if you have a hunch about how something works in nature, you look for something that would disprove it. You look for something that will falsify it, and you set up an experiment to make that falsification happen, if it can happen at all.
Right, and give the example that you make of the backyard gardener.
The backyard gardener, yeah. I mean, the thing is, a gardener actually engages in low-grade scientific method all the time. You want to know why this plant isn't thriving, okay? You've got several possibilities. You know, it might be something in the soil. It might be something in the water. You know, there are all these things that you can do. You try to eliminate as many of them as possible. The top tips of the leaf are turning yellow. That might be a calcium deficiency. What happens if I put some bone meal into this? That's actually a scientific test. You're making a hypothesis and falsifying it. And if it doesn't falsify, if you put the bone meal into there and water the plant and all of a sudden the tips of the leaves turn green again, guess what? You know, you're good to go.
Well, what's ironic is that this is such a simple thing. Mm-hmm. It is, in fact, in many ways intuitive. People mm-hmm. do use it unconsciously. Mm-hmm. And yet, on a system-wide, on a society-wide basis, there is a profound and widespread ignorance of mm-hmm. that. Greer isn't predicting a sudden apocalyptic collapse. It's a long decline. But he does forecast that the scientific establishment we have today will not survive the end of the industrial age.
I want to stress with the word collapse. A lot of people, when they say that, mean a kind of overnight Hollywood apocalypse where, you know, you have billions of corpses or maybe zombies strutting across the landscape and a handful of you know, your star survivors are, you know, left in an otherwise desolate world. That's not what I'm talking about. This is one of the reasons I use terms like decline and fall, because it's not an overnight process. What happened to Rome, what happened to so many other civilizations, is what I'm suggesting is in our future. Now, that makes something like science brutally vulnerable because, as I mentioned, science, the scientific institutionalized science, is a creature of the current system. It's funded by these very elaborate political and you know, social structures. It depends on that. You don't have many people who are prepared to make scientific discoveries by planting sweet peas in their backyard. And so as the social system comes unglued, as government ends up tearing itself to shreds, as, you know, you have various kinds of breakdowns and budget cuts and more budget cuts and still more budget cuts, maybe money loses its value at one point, hyperinflation or something, all these things happen. And if you don't have a recovery afterwards, if you don't have, you know, all of a sudden there's abundant money to put the laboratories back together and repair the damage to the observatory and all that kind of stuff, science as an institutional structure comes apart. Just as the Mayan priests who used to watch the stars from, you know, their pyramids down in Central America, you know, they had a marvelous system. They had mathematics and calendrics that were extremely sophisticated, and yet all that got lost because their society overshot its resource base. And, you know, there was no longer any money to pay for priests to sit and observe the stars. We could be in the same boat.
Now, you say utopia is not an option, but that humane, cultured, and sustainable societies in the future are.
Mm-hmm.
Through a lot of the book, it seemed to me that you were talking about kind of a rediscovery of the rural way of life. But then along the way, you said that actually cities of 20,000 to 200,000 might actually be the best arcs in a way.
Well, it's a complicated thing. A lot of people have this idea that the only thing to do if there's the possibility of some kind of social collapse is to run off in a cabin in the woods, preferably with enough firepower to stock a decent-sized panzer division. I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think it'll work. Is a more rurally-based life going to be an option? Is it going to be necessary? Absolutely. 100 years ago, half of the American population worked in agriculture. 100 years from now, we'll probably be in the same boat because we won't have the diesel fuel to power the combines and all that kind of stuff. And so it's back to, you know, hands and horses and hoes. And so, yes, we're going to see a major re-ruralization of the country. But I think it's also very, very important to remember that small to medium-sized cities can actually maintain themselves extremely well in much less centralized conditions. The old model of the city-state comes to mind. One of the basic patterns of human civilization for the last 5,000 years or more is a city surrounded by agricultural country, surrounded by farmland and things like that. And there's a lot of places in North America in particular where you basically have that situation. Where I am right now in Cumberland, Maryland, I'm you know, sitting in a town of 23,000 people, and it's mostly surrounded by, you know, in small farms and things like that, reaching off about two counties in any direction. This kind of thing is likely to be kind of the wave of the future. I suggest cities in particular because a lot of the people who read my book are not necessarily going to be well suited to go and back to a life of full-time farming. And so, you know, for them in particular, they might want to look at a small city somewhere in the midst of farming country where they can find some way to support themselves. Might be a little more convenient for them than, you know, up at the crack of dawn and out there to tend the pigs.
You talk about transition towns, and actually where I live, where we are right here, talking to you from Western Massachusetts, this is very much of a mixed rural, small urban area.
Yes, I've been to Western Massachusetts, beautiful country.
It is. Many of the towns here have groups, transition town groups. Mm-hmm. In fact, there is a transition town organizer who lives in the nearby town of Greenfield.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about your ideas about transition towns and maybe say what they are.
Well, the transition town idea, which was popularized by Rob Hopkins and has been getting a lot of press in the peak oil community recently in particular, the idea is that individual towns can actually make effective plans to deal with the transition from what I'm calling, you know, abundance industrialism to whatever we end up in the future. And they've evolved this particular strategy, this, you know, 12-step process for getting there and developing plans and things like that. And it's... I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, in some ways, it's very promising. But I also remember that by 1979 or 1980, just about every American municipality had a plan about how they were going to deal with the future and you know, reduce energy use and develop renewables. And none of it happened because making a plan is the easy part. Coming up with a plan that satisfies everybody's wildest dreams, that's the easy part. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's a lot easier than actually putting a plan into effect. I am skeptical of proposals that focus on consensus. And I know this is a little kind of an unpopular view nowadays. A lot of people think very highly of a consensus process. I worry that the pursuit of consensus involves squeezing things down to a lowest common denominator. What I would like to see instead is dissensus. Many different people, many different groups pursuing radically different programs with the thought that one of them, or many of them, might happen on possibilities that are not necessarily expected, are not necessarily consensus, but actually work.
Here we are facing a situation which, as you talk about in the book, we talk about depopulation, mm-hmm. mass starvation, mm-hmm. mass migration.
Oh, it's going to be a mess.
Climate
yeah.
change, loss of culture, mm-hmm. you know, greatly restricted resources, mm-hmm. learning to live in a way that, you know, we haven't learned. The generations now alive really most don't know, have a clue about how to learn within those
kinds
of limits.
We're basically stumbling back 200 years as a kind of rough estimate.
Right. And, and of course, with the idea in the book that, you know, there are some advances in our understanding that we can use. But nonetheless, and then you say democratic societies are possible. You know, most people think, most people have that kind of scenario, the survivalist scenario, mm-hmm. you know, that you're going to have to get out of the guns and defend your territory.
Well,
how are we going to make democracy work?
Well, a lot depends on what you mean by democracy, because the term has been, frankly, abused rather heavily in almost the last century, really. Democracy does not mean a system where everybody gets whatever they want. Democracy is a system where everybody participates in the process of making group decisions. The reason that I think democracy can work fairly well in this kind of situation, possibly even extremely well in this kind of situation, is that it worked very nicely in 1800. In America, when most people were living the kind of lifestyle that our grandchildren are going to have to live again. Town hall democracy?
Town meetings.
Town meetings. That kind of thing. And the sort of civil society that we've all but abandoned in our pursuit of mass anonymity and we will again have to invest our time and our efforts in the group, in the community. And a community meaning the people we actually live with, not some fantasy of, you know, a perfect community that we can build down the road someday when we have $1 billion in spare money to invest in all the hardware. But actually getting into the community where we actually live, getting involved in community organizations, weaving the fabric of civil society, that's where the future of democracy lies. In town meetings and, you know, school boards and local democracy. Because the thing that made American democracy flawed as it was and is, okay, the thing that made it possible and that made it capable of making so many positive changes over the last 200 years is precisely that it was rooted in people's everyday experience. You had the town meetings. You had all kinds of voluntary associations that had essentially democratic structures. You had lots of people belonging to the old fraternal lodges. You had people belonging to just all kinds of organizations. And because everyone knew how democracy worked on the ground, in their own lives, in their own town meetings, in their own organizations, it was fairly easy to build on that to come up with a governmental system which, flawed as it was, still provided a lot more civil rights to a lot more people and expanded its reach of civil rights as people gradually got a clue about some of the long-lasting problems that we had than most other societies have.
Well, your book, The Ecotechnic Future, Envisioning a Post-Peak World. Thanks so much, John Michael Greer, for this fascinating book and illuminating discussion.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be on.
John Michael Greer blogs at the Archdruid Report. That's because he's an archdruid. You can hear him talk about that and how druidism connects with his vision of the ecotechnic future. That's in a web-only extra on the webpage for today's show. And that's on the Writer's Voice website, www.writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.